I'm Willow Belden. A proposal to test water quality at oil and gas wells before and after drilling is making its way through the rulemaking process. The governor's office and industry hope it will answer some of the questions surrounding groundwater contamination near oil and gas development. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce reports, the rule may not actually be able to answer the question of who's responsible if contamination occurs, and that has some people questioning whether it's valuable at all.
The rule has been touted as the strongest in the country, but Bob Laresh with the Powder River Basin Resource Council says just because it's better doesn't mean it's good.
It really just doesn't do anything. It's kind of a phony sham of a regulation as far as I'm concerned.
Laresh says the rule is too limited in scope. It proposes testing water wells for a wide range of metals and a handful of petroleum derivatives, but not the many chemicals that are used in hydraulic fracturing. Laresh says in light of that, it only serves to muddy the issue of who's responsible for groundwater contamination when it occurs.
Let's have some proof one way or another, and not this phony thing that makes people feel warm and fuzzy but doesn't really prove anything.
In order to get that kind of proof, Laresh would like to see a requirement that companies include a unique tracer in the fluids they use for fracking. That way, it would only take one test to pinpoint the source of contamination. Right now, commercially available tracers can cost tens of thousands of dollars, and almost all of them involve radioactive elements. But that might not be the case in 6 months. Several companies are developing products that would act as fingerprints for frack fluid. In North Carolina, the state is considering regulations that would exempt drillers from certain testing requirements if they use a tracer. But that's not on the table in Wyoming. Jeremiah Reiman, the governor's natural resources advisor, says as it stands, the proposed rule isn't just about figuring out how fracking affects water. It's focused more broadly on understanding water quality.
This isn't a rule that deals with the drilling process, but that doesn't mean we won't go there. We did hear comments about it, and we need to evaluate that before we make a final determination.
Even though the proposed rule doesn't require testing for all of the possible frack fluid components, Reiman says it will provide a lot of good information about what's in people's water, information that isn't currently available.
Particularly those constituents that might be a true harm to health and human safety and those that potentially could be explosive.
Written comments submitted to the Wyoming Oil and Gas Conservation Commission suggest most people agree with that approach, that something is better than nothing. Amber Wilson is the Environmental Quality Coordinator for the Wyoming Outdoor Council.
There can't be anything more confusing about getting more information. I think that can only go towards helping to form better decisions in the future.
The Outdoor Council does want to see some tweaks to the proposed rule, including a lower sampling threshold for methane, the explosive gas that's been linked to groundwater contamination from oil and gas drilling in Pennsylvania. But Wilson says just because the rule isn't perfect doesn't mean it shouldn't move forward.
We do think it can be improved, but it can't be improved if it doesn't pass. So we have to start somewhere.
The oil and gas industry sees the rule as a compromise, too. John Robitaille is the vice president of the Petroleum Association of Wyoming. He says association members aren't happy with some details of the proposed rule. In particular, they'd like to get rid of the second round of post-drilling tests. They also want to only test wells within a quarter mile of the drilling pad, as opposed to the half mile currently proposed. But Robitaille says, generally speaking, the rule is a good idea.
We're hearing over and over and over that people believe that our activities are disrupting their groundwaters. If we test prior and post-drilling, then if nothing changes, then it's very clear that no, in fact, by doing what we do, we're not disrupting your groundwater.
But some experts say exonerating the oil and gas industry isn't going to be that easy. Kevin Shugg is a professor of chemistry at the University of Texas, Arlington, and he led a major study of water quality near oil and gas wells in that state. They tested for a wide range of contaminants, including frack fluid constituents. They didn't find those, but they did find elevated levels of arsenic in wells within 5 kilometers of oil and gas drilling pads. Since arsenic isn't used in the drilling process, Shugg says that suggests there may be indirect ways that drilling is causing contamination, ones that wouldn't be detected by simply adding a tracer to frack fluid. Wyoming's rule only deals with direct causes. For example, arsenic isn't part of the proposed testing. Shugg says while he understands there are economic constraints, limiting what's tested for now is a mistake.
You can only be so, prescient in seeing what the data is, and you just don't want to be coming back and saying, oh, I wish we had sampled for something else.
Because then we're back where we are now, just out lots of money. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Mary Kelly is the author of Coal in Campbell County, a book that traces the lineage of each of Gillette's major coal companies in the area. It's her second book about the coal industry in Gillette. She and her husband both worked for the Amex Coal Company for many years. Kelly told Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov that she wanted to preserve the history of the coal companies, but also show how they helped create a good life for people like her in Campbell County.
The fact that there have been so many changes in ownership and names and boundaries and things like that was really my motivation. I think when my generation is gone, there won't be anyone who knows about those earlier companies. So I wanted to get it down in writing, at least up to the present day, so people would know how those companies started. I think it's important for our area and for our state and probably for the nation to understand how these coal companies came about.
And the book is obviously very picture heavy. So how did you go about picking the pictures that you did?
I didn't want it to be a highly technical book. It's easy to be very, very technical when it comes to the coal. So I also think it's a nice thing to personalize the book and talk about some of the folks that are here in Gillette and Campbell County. It makes it fun for them. In particular, one picture I'm thinking of is Dusty Poppleton as about a 4 or 5 year old.
In front of the Christmas tree, right?
At the Festival of Trees.
Uh-huh.
She is just a little child, and now, of course, she's 20-some years old, and it shows that these people live here and work here, and their families are involved in the coal companies. And I thought it was a great photo, and of course, she's embarrassed about it, but but her grandmother gave me that photo, so I had to put it in.
My favorite chapter was about the Civilian Conservation Corps, which was brought in to put out coal mine fires. I had no idea there was such a camp in Wyoming. So I'm wondering, in your research, were there things you discovered that stood out for you?
I knew about the CCC camp because of a gal at the library who did a presentation about that a couple of years ago. And you're right, it is a very interesting part of Wyoming's history, especially because the camp was right here in Gillette at about 12th and 4J roads. So it's a part that's very much grown up. But to have it right here and the only CCC camp that was organized to put out coal fires is very unique. Some of the things that I enjoyed learning about was about the railroad, what the initials on the side of the rail cars stand for, and the fact that there are companies that take over driving the train at the mine, and the actual railroad crew goes off and drives some other train somewhere and uses their skills for that purpose, and this other company comes in and just drives the train through the mine while it's filled up, and then they leave, and an actual railroad crew comes back in and takes over for the haul to the power plants.
Hmm.
And that was something I didn't know there was even a market for.
Yeah. You dedicate the book to your husband and son and also thank the coal industry for a wonderful life. And throughout the book, too, your commentary is very complimentary towards the industry. I think at some point for one of the photos you say, for residents of Campbell County, a coal mine is beautiful. I'm wondering why you decided to focus so exclusively on the positive in the coal industry.
Actually, I feel very strongly that way. I think a lot of folks who live here in this part of the country and who make their living from the coal industry and who benefit from the coal industry feel that way. It's very disturbing to us when President Obama talks about how he wants to do away with coal mines and coal-fired power plants. And we have such a fabulous quality of life here due to the minerals that we have in our area. It really is a very positive industry in this part of the country.
All right. Well, Mary Kay, always a pleasure speaking with you.
All right. Thank you so much, Irina.
When we come back, we'll tag along on an antelope hunt and get an update on research into birth control for coyotes. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. Women still only make up a small percentage of all hunters, but that number has increased significantly in recent years. Now organizations like the Wyoming Women's Foundation want to encourage more growth through mentorship. The group says hunting is an important way to teach self-sufficiency and economic independence. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhurov tagged along on the state's inaugural Women's Antelope Hunt and filed this report.
The time of departure for each team of hunters was set for 5:30 a.m., but a snowstorm hit overnight, and at 6, the electricity was still out. Snow and wind howled outside, and antsy women in camouflage ate their eggs by candlelight. This was unusual October weather, even for Wyoming. Marilyn Kite was one of the first people who came up with the idea of the Women's Antelope Hunt. She was Wyoming's first woman to serve as Supreme Court Justice.
Unfortunately, there are not very many women that actively hunt.
In Wyoming, about 16% of hunters are women. Nationwide, that number is closer to 11%. But from 2006 to 2011, the number of women hunting in the U.S. increased by a quarter. And that's a trend Kite wants to encourage.
We've found it to be just great recreation, lots of fun, and the camaraderie of it is why you do it, really. But we also really like the meat.
The meat is kind of the clincher here. The event is sponsored by the Wyoming Women's Foundation, whose mission is to help women reach self-sufficiency.
There's a lot of young women who are single mothers who are trying to provide for their families, and that's certainly one way to do it.
Crystal Mayfield is a single mom from Laramie who was sponsored to come on the hunt. She's harvested elk before and hopes an all-women's hunt will take some of the intimidation out of the sport for others.
Well, I know a lot of people still have the mindset that hunting is a man's sport.
She was partnered with Terry Heaton of Gillette, who's a Navy veteran. Their guide was Fred Williams. Williams says women often make good hunters because they're more focused and patient than men. But there was very little patience that morning. They finally set off to the private ranch where they plan to hunt around 10 a.m.
About 29 degrees right now.
Just to show how outnumbered women are in hunting, most of the guides on this women's hunt were men, and both Mayfield and Heaton almost exclusively hunt with their dads. Heaton says the female camaraderie is a welcome change.
It's different than going with my dad and brother. A lot more giggling, I think.
As they drive, they take turns sliding down their mud and snow-streaked windows to look for antelope, and Williams quizzes Mayfield on her skill level.
I was doing 200 yards yesterday.
Really?
Yeah.
You're hitting in the bolt by 200 yards?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah.
Good for you. You're like Annie Oakley.
When they spot some antelope in the distance,
2 bucks to the right, right,
they park and start stalking them on foot. Williams has Mayfield load a bullet in the chamber, and they proceed quietly through a field strewn with cottonwoods and cows and covered in a lot of wet snow. When they reach a little rise that looks over the grazing antelope, Williams takes Mayfield up to prepare for her shot, and Heaton stays behind to wait and wait.
My legs are falling asleep.
Finally, Mayfield takes aim.
Here goes.
And shoots. She misses that buck. In fact, both women miss their shots that day. The 35-mile-an-hour winds don't make it easy to shoot. On the drive back to the ranch, Mayfield says she's not upset, but adds that missing is easier in the company of women.
When I missed that shot, I didn't feel like a loser when I went and told Tara that, oh, I missed it. Like, I didn't feel like she was going to be like, oh, you're a huge loser. So that was nice, too.
Is that what your dad would have told
me? My dad wouldn't have, but my brother easily would have been like, oh, I can't believe you missed that. Like, you're stupid.
As is typical in Wyoming weather, the next day is sunny, there's no wind, and it's beautiful. Both Heaton and Mayfield get their antelope in one shot and receive the Annie Oakley Award for it. In fact, 32 of the 34 women on the hunt fill their tags. One first-time hunter who got a buck says she can't wait to teach her son how to hunt. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhurov.
Last year, we reported on research that's being done at the University of Wyoming regarding coyote contraception. The idea is to use birth control to reduce coyote numbers and, in particular, to keep coyotes from killing livestock. The project now has some preliminary results, and Margie McGregor, who's leading the study, joins us now to talk about what they've found and what's next.
We have been using a drug called desirelin to see if we can induce a long-term suppression or a permanent suppression of the reproductive axis in the coyotes.
So in other words, birth control for the boys.
That's right, birth control for the boys.
And so what you've been trying to figure out so far is, does this work? Does this actually make them sterile?
Yes. And our research is focused on two main questions. One, the efficacy. You're right. Does this work? Does it make them sterile? Does it work short-term or long-term? And the other thing that we've been focused on is trying to make sure that there are no ill effects as a result of using this long-term drug. We don't want to decrease the fitness of the individual, just manage the reproduction.
I wanted to just step back for a moment and talk a little bit about why put coyotes on birth control. Traditionally, the means of dealing with coyotes has been culling or killing large numbers of them, lethal control. Why would we want to put them on birth control instead? Why would that help?
Well, I think that the question in the long term is, does just killing coyotes manage coyotes in the long term? And we have more coyotes than ever. We know that coyotes, in response to lethal control, undergo compensatory mechanisms for this. Females have larger litter sizes. Females start reproducing at a much younger age to make up for this ongoing hunting pressure. We also know that when coyotes have puppies, when they have their offspring, they tend to predate more on things like lamb. And this is research that's been done for quite some time, moving toward this suggestion that reproductive control is what we need, because we need to manage reproduction, and reproduction is the problem.
So in other words, if the coyotes are not having babies, if they don't have babies to take care of, they'll prey on other things and not people's livestock.
Yes, and there has been some good research that has shown that this is reduced when you compare coyotes in a sterile territory versus a non-sterile territory.
So you've had a number of test coyotes that you've been testing this on, and what have you found so far?
We have two different groups of coyotes that have been given two different formulations of the drug. And the first group, we had some coyotes that we were able to suppress reproduction, suppress sperm production, to clarify as well, for under 1 year. A second group we have, we've been able to suppress reproduction for 28 months plus. So we're going into the third breeding season. At this time, I don't know if they'll return to reproduction, but 2 years and counting.
So basically, that's good. That means this is working.
It is good. It's working thus far. So we're excited about that. We're also excited that we haven't had any side effects as a result of this long-term drug or long-term reproductive suppression. So yes, that is exciting.
So why might this have worked better in one group of coyotes than in the other? I mean, this is just, it's the same drug they're getting, but just sort of a different form of it.
It is. And the difference I should also tell you is one group was a pre-puberty group. The second group was post-puberty. So it's possible that it has to do with the process of this animal going through puberty and where they're at. And the drug, something's going on there. We're not exactly sure.
Until now, one of the things that you've not been focusing on is behavior. You know, does this drug affect the behavior of the coyotes? Sounds like that's what you're moving on to next. Can you talk about that a little bit?
It is. We are definitely interested in the question of behavior. It's always been a question. But first, our goal has been, does the drug work? And the second goal has been to monitor these health effects. I think we're at the point now where it's time to start looking at behavior, because that could affect whether or not we continue down this route of drug development. One of the first things that we're going to start looking at is effects to mating integrity. So coyotes do mate for life. They do have a strong pair bond. If we alter testosterone in the male, is that going to dissolve the pair bond? The male is no longer going to be interested in that female during the breeding season, and the male, another male on the outside of the territory, might move on in, chase that male off.
Or the female might not be interested in the male anymore.
Absolutely. And exactly. The female might not be interested in the male. And they both actively defend the territory year-round. So we just don't want to have any changes to any of that. We want them to still be mating, even without testosterone. I just want to clear, I mean, that does happen in domestic dogs. that have been castrated 3 years post-castration, they still mate. So we're not sure.
So in order for this drug to be useful, the pair still has to stay together, the pair still has to be mating and do everything that they normally do, and they have to still stick around the same territory that they would normally stick around in. Otherwise, other coyotes would just move in and take their place.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the idea is not to disrupt any effects to sociality, mating behavior, anything.
So I wanted to look at maybe a little bit of the social aspect of this here. From my point of view, when I've talked to a lot of ranchers, they tend to be skeptical of means of coyote control other than killing the coyotes. They're like, well, shooting them works, you know, maybe not permanently. Maybe, yes, you do have more coyotes moving in later on, but at least for a couple months we get rid of the coyotes. We don't have to worry about them. So assuming that you do find out that it's okay behaviorally for the coyotes and you go to the next step of trying to use this, is this going to be hard to get ranchers to sign on to say, okay, we're going to try this rather than just taking them out?
Oh, definitely. I think it's definitely going to be hard. It's hard for people to understand that contraception might provide a solution. And I think that it will be difficult. But one of the things that we also need to understand is this idea of contraception for coyotes has implications beyond Wyoming, beyond the local agriculture community. We have urban spread of coyotes. This may be relevant to places like downtown Chicago, to New York City, where they're starting to question how might we manage growing coyote populations.
All right. Well, Margie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Willow.
Margie McGregor is a PhD candidate at the University of Wyoming. She's conducting research into coyote contraception.
When we come back, we'll hear about kids using iPads, and we'll talk with writer Sherman Alexie. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. Author, poet, and filmmaker Sherman Alexie spent the past several days on the University of Wyoming campus. His visit started with a public lecture, more like an improv comedy sketch about Native American identity. And Wyoming Public Radio's Micah Schweitzer sat down with Alexie to discuss some of the themes in his talk.
In an article in The Atlantic this week, Sherman Alexie reveals a favorite line of poetry, the one that set him on the path to writing.
Adrian Lewis, a Paiute poet, wrote a poem called Elegy for the Forgotten Oldsmobile. And the first line of the poem is, "Oh, Uncle Adrian, I'm in the reservation of my mind," which completely captures the notion of a colonized mind and the barriers and boundaries put out by outside forces that you completely accept. And that extends beyond natives. So one of the things I say is we all get trapped.
Alexie's lectures, like the one earlier this week at UW, are part of an effort to free us from prejudice and preconception.
When you think your experience, when the circle you live in is the circle everybody lives in. You know, if you Venn diagrammed it, there'd be this big circle in the middle called whiteness, which you can also call Americanness. White people live mostly in that circle. And it's when people start assuming everybody shares that circle. When, I mean, I certainly share a lot of it, but my circle would probably be, 70 or 80% Americanness, whiteness, and then the rest of it would be my indigenous identity. And sort of certainly my far left politics put me outside that typical Americanism.
That Venn diagram, I suppose you could also do a male-female Venn diagram.
Oh, too. Certainly. Women are not totally in that circle of Americanness at all. Not even white women are in there. There's this whole other circle off to the side. You could really call that circle white guys and those of us who, in order to survive, have to believe and think like white guys. That's the name of that circle in the middle.
Sherman Alexie has lived in Seattle for many years now, but he grew up on the Spokane Indian Reservation. At his lecture, Alexie drew parallels between reservations and the concentration camps of World War II. He calls reservations an act of war.
The U.S. government and the U.S. military herded, and I use herded pointedly, Native Americans onto their reservations. It was rural concentration camps. We were supposed to go there and die. By and large, almost exclusively, they put us in regions without enough natural resources for us to survive. They gave us very limited supplies. In the early days of the reservations, people were dying of starvation, malnutrition, exposure. So they created these stationary jail cells. And only through this amazing perseverance and luck did we survive.
But Alexi says the problem is some Native Americans have come to embrace the reservation as part of their cultural identity.
In the early part of my career, I heard from a lot of other Indians, and I felt it myself that what I was doing wasn't very Indian.
Being a writer.
Yeah, and, being a writer. And then I was on
living
stage.
Living in a city.
I was living on stage. And I was on stage performing, and I thought, wait a second. I travel the world telling stories. How traditional is that? That's the oldest activity known to human beings. I'm the traditional one. Why did I ever let Indians who manage casinos make me feel less Indian than them? So when you start talking about Native American culture in its present sense, number one, it's urban. Approximately 70% of Native Americans live off the reservation. So the notion that the reservation is even our primary identity is completely wrong and has been untrue since at least the early 1950s. And we don't see it for what it is. Every single non-Indian in this country has the same exact idea about what Indian is.
Where does that come from?
1950s Westerns.
So how do we get past that?
Well, I'm trying. I think I've helped a bit, and there are other Native artists trying, but it really goes up to Native artists. Number one, the big thing is we Native artists, writers, filmmakers, painters, sculptors, have to stop being so res-centric. You know, you would never guess that 70% of Natives live off the reservation, judging by our art. And this often by Natives who've never lived on the res. So, number one, to combat this image of who we are or aren't, Native artists have to start representing us as we are.
But you're saying that there's the white image, which is, you know, anchored in the 50s, which is anchored in the some sort of mythical combination of pre-Columbian and 19th century America. Now, that's part of the problem, but that Indians themselves are perpetuating the image.
Yes. Indian artists have been remaking Last of the Mohicans for 100 and some odd years now.
You singled out a couple in the audience, somewhere in the front rows, and I somehow doubt these are their real names. You called them
Grizzly Adams and Sacagawea?
Yes, Grizzly Adams and Sacagawea, a white man and an Indian woman, and you said the healing process begins with them.
Yes, I mean, where else would the healing process more wonderfully begin than in bed? But it really is if you can hand your life over to somebody in a trusting, loving partner way, I mean, so much historical forgiveness happens. Well, the goal is really, I mean, is for us to intermarry so much that we all look exactly alike. And then we have to think of really complicated reasons to hate each other.
And so until that happens, what are, I'm already married to a white woman.
You're doomed. You're doomed.
You know, what can I do to be part of the healing process?
Lots of affairs and illegitimate brown children.
I hope my wife doesn't listen to this interview.
But, I mean, the sex, the romantic relationship is just a metaphor for the kind of close friendships I'm talking about. The nature of reaching across barriers and boundaries with your most intimate decisions. Not just marriage. Friendship. I mean, it comes down to, you know, tomorrow when I have lunch in the student dining hall, I'm going to do my best to sit next to somebody who doesn't look exactly like me. And one of the ideas that really kind of peeves me, not so much, mostly I'm sort of amused by it, is the notion of, well, you have to tolerate, acceptance, tolerate. No, that's easy. It's about more than that. I mean, I'm aiming for celebration. You know, I give non-Indians a whole lot of crap. I give white guys in particular a whole lot of crap. But holy smokes. White dudes took us from covered wagons to space shuttles in less than a century. I mean, that's amazing. It was white dudes who created this amazing Constitution and Declaration of Independence that had to be amended over the years by non-white dudes. But in its original ideas, the world had never seen anything like it. So, I mean, I have deep, abiding affection, love, and respect for Western civilization and European culture. It just isn't often returned.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Micah Schweitzer talking with writer Sherman Alexi. Wyoming was once wet, balmy, and full of creatures like dinosaurs. Today, their fossils are slowly weathering out of the ground. If the bones happen to be on public land, researchers are granted permits to dig for them, and the fossils have to end up in a public repository. But on private land, anyone can dig, and they can do whatever they want with the specimens. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Joroff reports that commercial or independent collectors are sometimes eyed warily.
Bob Johnson's family has been on their ranch outside of Lusk since 1887. Paleontologists started knocking on their door not too long afterward.
Some paleontologists had come out and found some fossil remains of something and marked it on a map, so we were literally known worldwide. Might have been in a very small clique, but but we were known. People knew about it.
Johnson says he opens his land up to fossil hunters in the name of knowledge, but he wouldn't be opposed to a big, valuable dinosaur find either.
Not expecting, but it's always, there's a little grain of hope in there.
Paleontologist J.P. Cavagelli visits the ranch frequently. For now, he pays Johnson for access to his land with a bottle of Captain Morgan. Cavagelli's Subaru is weighed down with camping gear, fossils, and digging equipment. He parks on a sandy road, walks a ways through shrub and prickly desert brush, and plops down on an indistinct mound of dirt. He checks on the spot regularly.
Let's see what we can find. With my little knife here, that's the bone, that's the sandstone that's coming up. Hear the difference?
What looks like rocks scattered on the ground are actually fragments of dinosaur bones and remains of other ancient creatures.
There's pieces of bone here and there. There's a little blue thing here. That's probably a gar scale.
Cavagelli works at the Tate Geological Museum in Casper. In that role, he's an educator. But he also used to run a fossil outfitting business and still collects fossils for his own private collection. He doesn't see a conflict between public research and independent collecting.
I think there's some of the good stuff that's come out of the commercial industry, especially, is, you know, we have these fossil fish quarries in western Wyoming where they collect thousands of fossil fish every summer, but because they're digging big holes and aggressively digging, collecting, they find the cool stuff, the rarities, the turtles, the crocodiles, the mammals, and the birds, and the rarities are what make the commercial outfits earn their keep.
Others are not so flexible.
The fossil record is an international cultural and educational resource.
That's retired University of Wyoming professor of geology and zoology, Jay Lilligraven.
I believe that fossils belong to all of humanity, and they should not be owned by individuals. They should not be affixed with price tags.
Lilligraven's stance is philosophical, but born of practical considerations.
Ranchers, landowners are given the impression that fossils do have a monetary value. And everybody wants to be rich. Everybody wants to have enough money to live. I can't blame them. But those of us in the professional line of paleontology never have access to that kind of money.
He says museums and public collections could be outbid by private collectors, and science could suffer as a result. Lilligraven says unless a public institution does the excavation, scientific data collection may be incomplete. Mike Trebold disagrees. He runs a paleontology business. He digs on private land and sells fossils to private collectors, works for public museums, and runs his own museum.
I would say that most of the people who do this for a living are making a serious commitment and probably either scientifically trained or have a tremendous amount of experience by the time they're doing it for a living. And if you are doing it for a living, you have to provide all of this information or you can't compete with those of us that do.
Furthermore, he says it's not as though the high prices for choice fossils are just made up.
It's not the ooh-ah factor that gives it the big price. It's the fact that you have just put thousands upon thousands of hours worth of work into it, and you're rolling the dice. And if you don't get a good price for it, you're going to go broke.
Trebold pays landowners he works with 10%. He adds that a lot of the stuff found on private land ends up in public collections anyway. His outfit has a policy that if they find a rare specimen, they try extra hard to get it into a public repository. Indeed, he says independent collectors have a lot to offer.
If you happen to be a specialist, we are free to collaborate back and forth to add to your body of knowledge because we're not affiliated with any institution. We are independent collectors.
He also says independent collectors are more likely to have the time and money to dig for fossils. That could be a good thing for everyone involved, since Wyoming has a lot of private land that's slowly eroding away to unveil fresh bones. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhorov.
As schools look at new ways to improve education, in Thermopolis, they're hoping that new technology and the access it brings to databases, videos, and better access to the outside world will improve learning and teaching. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck has more.
This is Hot Springs County High School, home of the Bobcats. The school is not struggling with its overall performance, but it is trying to improve education through technology. The district technology director is London Jenks. Jenks is a young faculty member who's taught high school science at the school for just over 3 years.
All the information you need there from the deer count. You have to take what you know about quadrant sampling method and change the average into an actual deer estimate in town.
When you are in his classroom, it does not seem a lot different than other science classes you've attended. It includes gear for experiments and has the standard charts and tables you'd find anywhere. But the students all have laptops and iPads. Jenks says he has a paperless classroom.
They have no textbook to forget. You know, they have no papers to leave at home. So it gives them that access whenever they need it. A majority of our students have iPhones or other smartphones. They also have school-issued iPads. And so they have that access.
What Jenks means when he says they have access is that they have access to their assignments, their class materials, and even their teacher, no matter where they are. In Jenks' classroom, the students often have to do additional research, like a current project where they're using technology to count deer populations. Senior Ivy Paris says it helps her learn.
We kind of have to force ourselves to learn the stuff and do our assignments. Like, there's really not a lot of interaction from the teacher. Like, there's the proper amount of interaction, but it's not like he's standing up there and telling us what to do the whole time, which I think is very nice because I think it's almost a more interactive learning, so you almost learn better doing that.
The students carry their technology with them, and student Caden Wood says that helps him.
I feel like I'm learning more, and I'm learning more at my own pace, and just I'm being more thoroughly engaged in the information rather than someone just talking at me. I'm really, like, involved in what I'm doing.
Students say online interaction is a big part of learning at the school, and they can ask questions when they aren't in school. Jenks was trained by Google and is known as a Google-certified teacher. His training makes lectures come alive. For example, he recently had a lecture about tectonic plates.
Technology allows me to show my students where tectonic plates interact anywhere in the globe. You know, we use Google Earth and navigate around Google Earth, and we can see, you know, where those plates interact. We can pull up at the same time and overlay, you know, earthquakes on that and recent earthquakes. We can overlay where volcanoes are, and that's at another level that, you know, you can't just do with paper.
Jenks has even developed apps for his class. Government and American history teacher Brenna Dooley has a technology certification as well. She has added technology components in her teaching and has noticed a difference.
They are way more attentive, learning through videos and pictures that go along still with the content, but it's more in line delivered in a different manner than direct instruction. As I guess I was used to.
But there's another side to all of this. The school and the district are also using technology to better track student performance, and technology can alert them when a student needs what they call an intervention or extra time with a teacher. Principal Travis Anderson says it will help educators make sure that students are meeting standards.
Now the technology is available to outline what those standards are, to show how students are progressing, analyze that data, and then develop approaches that can best meet the learning needs of those students. And that's where the technology is, can meet the learning needs of every student on a daily basis.
Jenks says he's going to take data tracking a step further.
We're actually working on a system in our district that will allow me to see which assignments Johnny's working on right now, and when was the last time he worked on that assignment.
T. Teachers spend a lot of time on data collection, and Jenks says if they can free up teachers' time for them to concentrate on teaching and make their lessons more interesting, that's better for everyone. They haven't done this long, and so it's premature to see if it's working, but Jenks does believe they're on the cutting edge. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
When we come back, we'll visit another school, one that's teaching some of its classes in Chinese. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. A school in Casper has started teaching some of its classes in Chinese. The idea is that the students in those classes will grow up bilingual. This is the first Chinese immersion program in a Wyoming school, but data from other states that have similar programs show a wide range of benefits. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports.
Miss Lee's classroom at Paradise Valley Elementary School looks a lot like other kindergarten classrooms. There are bins of art supplies, colorful pictures on the walls, and tables that are just the right size for five-year-olds. Miss Lee is doing a lesson in counting, drawing shapes on a whiteboard with colorful markers. What's different about this class is that everything is in Chinese. These kindergartners are in a dual language immersion program. Half the day they have class in English and the other half in Mandarin. Aaron Wilson is the principal. He says the way they're learning Chinese is very different than the way most people have learned foreign languages.
They're actually learning math, social studies, and science content in Chinese. It's not being translated for them. There is no English spoken in that class by the teacher.
When Wilson says no English, he means no English. The teacher even spoke Chinese to me when I visited the classroom. The whole thing may sound impossible. You throw a bunch of English-speaking kids into a class and expect them to pick up Chinese without translating a single word. But it seems to be working. The kids already know how to count to 100, they can tell simple stories, and they've learned songs. The hope is that by the time the kids graduate high school, they'll be proficient, if not fluent, in Mandarin. Taya True Wells is one of the parents who pushed to get the dual language program started. She says she wants her son to be bilingual, and she has other goals for him, too.
I also hope that he looks at the world differently than I did growing up in Wyoming, where it was very much about the border of Wyoming. It wasn't necessarily about the globe. And my hope is that even if he never uses Mandarin, that there will be an appreciation for other cultures and just how vast and different and exciting the world can be.
Plus, there's the business aspect of it. Wyoming is looking to export large amounts of coal to China. Chinese companies are investing in oil production here. And just in general, China is the world's second largest economy. So knowing Mandarin is not a bad thing to have on your resume.
Most businesses are just really, really begging and pleading for more bilinguals. And so these kids are going to be ready for that world.
That's Virginia Collier. She's a professor emerita at George Mason University and has done extensive research on bilingual education. She says Mandarin is a good choice of language because so many people speak it. But she says learning any language is useful.
It just expands your thinking skills. It expands the parts of your brain that you use.
Collier says once you know one language, it's easier to learn others, even if the languages are very different. Plus, studies have shown that kids who grow up bilingual are more creative and have better problem-solving skills than their monolingual counterparts. They're also doing well on standardized tests, and not just when it comes to foreign languages. Greg Roberts is a language immersion specialist in Utah, where 20,000 students are in dual language immersion programs, just like the one in Casper.
Dual language immersion students are on par or actually scoring higher than their monolingual peers in English language arts, math, and science.
For now, the program in Casper is just for kindergartners, but the school hopes to add an additional grade level each year so that it becomes a K-12 program. Parents are also pushing for similar programs in Spanish. And experts like Virginia Collier say that eventually dual language immersion could become the new norm for elementary education across the country. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and we're going to hear a story about abuse that stemmed from alcoholism. This interview was recorded as part of StoryCorps, a project that records conversations between loved ones. In this case, 89-year-old Myrtle Forney talks with her grandson, Nate Swinton. After her first husband, Nate's grandfather, passed away, she married another man named Ken.
I met him in a grocery store. Well, I'd known him as an engineer. We both worked for the railroad, and I knew who he was, but I just thought, oh, he's not married, and he's a nice man, and he's good-looking, and I'd like to know him better. And he came, I was in the grocery store buying meat when he came up to the counter to get some for himself, and I said, you buy it, and I'll cook it. And that's how we met.
And then you were married.
That's right.
You must have done a good job cooking the steak. Did you have a happy marriage with Ken?
It was a rocky marriage. It turned out he was an alcoholic.
And in addition to being an alcoholic, he was suffering from Alzheimer's.
That's true. But the last 6 years, he had Alzheimer's. To get really personal on this, if we'd have sex, he didn't know who he was having sex with. To me, Alzheimer's was not nearly as difficult to work with as the alcohol was. He would get angry with me for something, and he'd fight me. He'd hit me. He'd toss me around. He'd throw the dishes on the floor at home. And his lawyer had told me, if he gets mean, run. And so I just ran away from home. I moved away from home twice while I lived with him. Got myself an apartment both times. Lived away from him. He would come and see me and be really nice and beg me to come back home, and he wouldn't do that again, but that happened all the time. When he got drunk the first time on our honeymoon, and I didn't even realize what was going on. Are you sick or what's going on? Because I hadn't seen him drunk, and we'd gone together for several years before we got married, so that was a real surprise to me that he'd been able to control it. But after that, it happened about every 6 months.
Did you ever think about getting a divorce?
Yes, I even talked to a lawyer about getting a divorce. And then that, again, when he pinned notes on my car and come back and everything will be all right, we'll work it out, and that happened. And I forgave him, and we got along for another 6 months. But we went to treatment at Norton, Kansas, for alcoholics. And I went as the spouse of an alcoholic. And it certainly helped me, because it helped my self-esteem to have been through that treatment. We just learned how to handle each other better, and he continued to drink. So there were a lot of times that things were really bad.
Was it hard for you to have that type of second marriage after your first marriage was such a happy time?
Well, certainly it was hard, and I'd never had any time like that with my first husband. It was a very difficult life. My children knew what was happening. They were grown and gone from home. But they sympathized with me and wondered why I put up with it. And like I say, I did leave home twice for extended periods where I moved my furniture, and I reported him when he was being mean, always. It would be really hard for me to give advice, because I went back so many times. I could say, don't go back. Don't go back. Leave the first time. First time anybody's mean, or if it hits you at all, leave, because it's just going to get worse, is what I would say now. But I didn't take my own advice, and we did stay together until his death, but he took his life by shooting himself.
And that's a very tragic experience for you to come home and find your husband. What was that like for you?
It was terrible. I can't think of words to describe it, but I just started screaming and ran out the door, because the guy that I worked with was across the alley, and he'd just come home from work for lunch too. And I told him what had happened and ran in and grabbed the phone and dialed 911, and but I said, he's dead. He's dead. And just sat down on the couch and started crying, and people heard it over the loudspeaker system and were there coming in my door to help me. And then after I relaxed and the funeral was over and I realized, I was thankful that he'd done it. I think he did it for me as well as for himself, because he knew what a trial he was to me.
That was Myrtle Forney talking with her grandson, Nate Swinton. The piece was produced by Willow Belden, with interviews recorded at StoryCorps. StoryCorps is a national nonprofit whose mission is to provide Americans of all backgrounds and beliefs with the opportunity to record, share, and preserve the stories of our lives.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for a podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates and less important information, you can follow all of us on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.